Well, good morning, everybody. It's good to see you all again. These weeks go awfully fast, at least in between when I'm preparing for the next one. It seems like it gets here so quickly. But it's good to be back. And yeah, the political, I've been trying to toss in little connections in terms of the politics, certainly then. And that'll keep coming out. Next week, we'll try to pull a few threads together as well. So I hope you'll all be thinking about that in terms of kings and so forth. But you'll see that as we go. So we are talking about we three kings and a fourth. But this week we hit the third one. And you may remember 2 weeks ago we talked about Saul, a good king gone bad. And last week we talked about David, a good king with feet of clay. And this week it's Solomon, a wise but foolish king. You see a thread there about these kings? Something good about them, but then there's a problem. And that seems to be the way the thread works along the way. I thought I'd do something a little bit different to start today and ask you two questions. So the first question is simply this. When a king dies, who would normally be expected to be their successor? Pretty simple. The oldest son. Huh. That already tells you something about ancient times, but maybe also modern times, if people have kings. And that leads me to think about poor king, Prince Charles. If I've got it figured out right, he's turning 68 this year at some point. Don't know when his birthday is exactly, don't remember. His mother has been on the throne for 53 years already, and so far there aren't any signs that she's going to abdicate in his favor, and so forth. So, you know, he could be 78 when he finally ends up as king, potentially. He's not going to rule that long. He's not going to have that title that long. Maybe it doesn't bother him. He might be quite happy about that. I don't know. I don't know if anybody follows the royals over here very much. I've never met anybody who did, but that doesn't prove anything. It could be that some of the tensions that we hear about in the family have kept her from wanting him on the throne. Who knows? I mean, I don't for sure. But it does strike me that, you know, he's the one who's to be the successor, and there he is in waiting. It's a terrible thing, I would think, to be waiting to become the king, because what you're waiting on is for your father or mother, in this case, to die or to finally abdicate. And you don't really want to lose your parent if they're in good health and, you know, all those kinds of things. He must be in a very awkward situation. Well, as we will see, this is not exactly the way the ancients tended to look at it. So, who should have been David's successor? Absalom. Maybe. Of course, Absalom's dead by the time David dies. And Absalom wasn't the first either, was he? Remember last week, the incident with Tamar, the oldest son? No, actually, he's. It would be after Absalom. Where do you think Solomon falls in the line? Pretty low. Yeah, actually, it's kind of interesting to read the text in this regard. These are the sons of David, and this is repeated actually from in Chronicles from 1 Kings, pretty much repeated. These are the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron, where David resided before he took Jerusalem, if you remember that from last week. First was Amnon. He's the one who lusted after Tamar, Absalom's sister. The second was Daniel. Now, 1 Kings gives a different name for him, and we never hear of him again. So it sounds like he died young, or he just doesn't play in any narrative particularly. Third is Absalom. The fourth is Adonijah. Keep that name in mind. Fifth, Shephatiah. Then Ithream. So there's six who were born to him in Hebron. So he's got six sons, where he reigned seven, These were born to him in Jerusalem. So they're all later, obviously. Shimeah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. So if you count that up, where does that put Solomon? That makes him 10th. And notice those four who are named are by what woman? Bathsheba, whom we heard about last time too, obviously. But the text keeps on going and lists, and I left out all those names. There's no space for them up here. Besides, we never hear anything more about them anyway. They're like all of us. When we're gone, we're gone. History books aren't going to be remembering us particularly. There were nine more. The curiosity about that is, it doesn't even say when these nine were born. Some of them could have been born before Solomon was, because Bathsheba's get listed together. So Solomon is way down the line. He's the youngest of Bathsheba. He must have been a favorite of David's. And that, again, sounds... Remember last time we talked about Joshua? Jacob and favoring Joseph? Maybe, again, there's a little bit of that theme replaying itself here. A young son in older age. So maybe Solomon is 19th or something like that in the lineup. Regardless, he's way down the line. There's nothing in terms of the way the kingship is set up that would suggest that he should be the king, except it's not set up very clearly yet. So whatever happens is going to happen. All of these were David's sons, and then it mentions, oh, by the way, he had concubines as well as queens or princesses and had a whole bunch of children from them. And, by the way, there was a daughter. She was named Tamar. In the Old Testament, you name the daughters or the women who are significant, right? And that means they do something significant, like a couple of the judges are women, or something bad happens to them, and that makes them significant. Otherwise, they don't even get mentioned. Okay, so what I wonder about in this regard, just raise this for your thinking, is if Solomon becomes king, she's the youngest of Bathsheba. You know, ladies, how you love the youngest, or at least there's a sense of that's the baby in the family, and special care is to be taken for the baby. It often happens, not always, thankfully. But when all of that happens and she's somehow very close to David, is it possible that she's not quite the innocent victim that we tend to assume in David's affair with her? I'm not in any way saying that David is okay or is let off the hook because of that, but what happens in the story, and we don't have time to read it all, is that she sees that another son, and that would be the one mentioned up here, Adonijah. Adonijah is trying to take the throne before his dad dies. He knows David's on the deathbed. He wants to solidify his power. Bathsheba sees that. Nathan the prophet sees that. And together, they work David to anoint Solomon as the successor before he passes away. So you see Bathsheba in this account as being conniving potentially, certainly politically astute. And in that regard, you get the sense that she gets what she wants. And if you back that off then to when David has the affair with her, here she is, a beautiful woman, bathing on her rooftop in view of the king's palace. We usually just read over that, but she's also married to a Hittite who is inferior. in the way they understood culture, other groups, and we don't know anything about that, of course. But the assumption was a Hittite is way down the line in terms of their value, which is part of the reason David doesn't have too many compunctions about having him killed. So, you know, she may have been, and what's she doing married to a Hittite anyway? So you begin to think, maybe she was trying to find a way out of that. Maybe she was upwardly mobile or something along those lines. I don't know, but it does strike me that it would be wise to watch for motives of people who want something from you, who are asked something from you, who befriend you, or otherwise offer you things. I mean, that's literally all we know, so you can draw your own conclusions. But it does strike me that, yeah, sometimes we look at a narrative just from one perspective, and that perspective is David is horrendous in what he does here. And so, you know, the finger gets pointed at him. Three commandments have been violated, etc., etc. But maybe there's more happening along with that. Doesn't take away from it again. In no sense do I mean that. But I just kind of wonder. That was question number one. who is the usual successor? And as you see, it's not at all what you would expect in this case. And then the second question is, in the Bible, how long does a good king reign anyway?
30 years.
Not 30, but you're not too far off. Till he dies. Well, that's true. One way or the other. I'm looking for a number, though. And we'll come back to why in just 1 second. Anybody? Okay, well, let's take another look at the part that I passed over in this text we just looked at. Notice, in Hebron, these six were born to David, where he reigned for 7 years and 6 months. And he reigned 33 years in Jerusalem. Now, this is a math class, so the total is 40. 40. Now, jumping ahead to the end of Solomon's life, basically, we read this summarizing his reign. The time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. He slept with his ancestors and was buried in the city, And his son Rehoboam succeeded him. 40. Well, that's twice 40 is mentioned. Can you think of any other times the number 40 shows up in the Old Testament? 40 days and 40 nights of rain for the flood, Noah. So in the earliest chapters of Genesis, we've already got 40. In this case, days. This is years, but it's 40. Anything else? Moses. Anybody remember that at all? Well, the story, as it's presented to us, is it's 40 years that gets him from birth to having to flee Egypt. It's 40 years living in the desert, and then it's 40 years leading the Israelites. So it's 120 years. 3 times 40. Any others?
Didn't Jesus go out?
Oh, yep. New Testament. Jesus goes into the desert and is tempted for 40 days. We are between, right now, Easter and the Ascension, which occurred how many days after Easter? See, we're not a liturgical church. You would know this if you were Anglican or Episcopalian or Catholic or Greek Orthodox or whatever. But we Presbyterians don't do much with that. That's 40 days. It's another 40 days. 40 just keeps reappearing. So what's so significant about 40? It can be a generation.
Doesn't seem just a long time.
sort of a long time, but there's something about the long time. As close as I can figure it out. And nobody really talks about this that I've seen. But I think what it really refers to is a complete time. For a length, a good length. So the 40 days of rain, that's going to take care of everything. 40 years of traveling, that certainly is a generation. Or a lifetime, adult lifetime in a sense, in those days. Or an entire lifetime. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So something about the number just jumps out. Okay? But, you know, the point I want to make, and the reason I'm stressing this is, it doesn't, when we get to the later kings, some of the later kings will be said to have ruled for 40 years. That tells you they were a good king. Other kings ruled other lengths of time. And notice, remember when we, 2 weeks ago, I showed you the text for Saul. How long did Saul reign? Anybody remember that? Wasn't one of the more major points, but there's a textual. I had a question mark by the number. The text doesn't tell us. It got dropped out. So you wonder if the one possibility is that the writer didn't want to say how long it was because his rule was unsuccessful. Something like that. Anyway, 40 is a popular number. Put it that way. What other numbers in the Bible are popular? 7? 3? 12? Mm-hmm. Oops, boy. Try this one again. I don't write like this very often, as you can tell. 10 can be as well. Yeah. Yeah. And 40 is the other big one. Oh, there is one there in between here. So since we're doing math today, too, what's 7 minus 3?
4.
3 plus 4 is 7. One of the traditional things is that the heaven or God is the number 3. Trinity. 4 is the four corners of the earth, etc., the four winds, all those kinds of things. It becomes a number symbolizing the earth. Put 3 and 4 together, you have the totality of everything. And 7, then, is a perfect number. That's also true, yeah. Yeah, it happens to be 4. That's correct, yeah. Yeah, so in other words, numbers are symbolic. And you need to keep that in mind. When it says 40, it doesn't necessarily mean precisely 40. It means things that are related to it. It's trying to say this was the right time period. So anyway, you'll see that lots of times. One other one is 6. But 6 is one less than 7, which makes it imperfect. And if you take 3 times anything, you make that thing perfect. So 3 times 6, you get 666, right? That's why Revelation has the mark or the number of the devil is 666. Pure imperfection or pure evil. John?
What's the significance of one of the books of the Bible being called Numbers?
The book, the Old Testament book called Numbers, because the beginning of the book talks about a census of Israel. How many were there in? Yeah, yeah. It's significant also because they were not supposed to do that. Something about trying to be too precise, so it's not really looked at positively. But that's why the number gets there. And Exodus really is there because that's when they leave Egypt. Genesis is the beginning. Deuteronomy means second law. And Leviticus is all that Levitical code stuff. So it's all just, you know, what's going on in that book. Okay, anyway. Solomon, back to him and himself. A few things I want to mention about him. First of all, the thing that we all know, right? He's acclaimed to be a prototypical wise man. And the wisdom comes in the sense of the story that God speaks to him. God asks him what he would like to have. As you know, God speaks to him at night at Gibeon, where he was living at the time, and asks Solomon, what do you want? And Solomon says, well, look at me. And notice what he says about himself. O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, although I am only a little child. So he stresses his humility and maybe literally his youth, as we've just seen. And your servant is in the midst of the people whom you have chosen, a great people. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil. So he asks for wisdom, understanding. They're interchangeable terms in the Old Testament. And in asking for that, of course, you know what God responds with. I'll give you that and what? In addition, I'll make you wealthy as well. I'll give you all, because you didn't ask to be wealthy, which most people would, when you get the chance to have anything you want. I've been wanting that new car. I wanted to be sure my IRA's good for retirement for anything that might happen. I've wanted da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, I'd love to have that. At least that's the picture that's being presented. And Solomon says, give me wisdom. And God says, you've got it. And then there's one story, of course, that tells how wise he actually is and he becomes famous for. It is what? I'll cut a baby in half. Sounds kind of... except for the story, right? Two women claiming that the baby is theirs, one of whom is lying. How can you get the truth out? Well, say, I'll just divide the baby in half. And the woman who really is the mother, last thing she would want. The other mother is so upset and distraught and concerned about her loss that she wants to see the other woman lose too. So you got it. You know exactly. And that's the story that's used to show how significant he is as in terms of wisdom. From that, then we get the book of Proverbs named for Solomon. Starts out, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. He becomes known as the prototypical person of wisdom in Israel. Everything related to wisdom is then attached to his name. So the book of Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. There's also the Psalms of Solomon at a later... it's not in our Bible, it's in the Apocrypha. But he comes to be known as that. This is also something that's typical of the way the Old Testament works. A given person is made, in a sense, the author of or the prototypical example of something. You might think of Abraham, who would be what? Father of the whole nation. Starts it all off. Yeah, he is the patriarch of all. What about Moses? You know what he's known as? It's the books of Moses, the law of Moses, or the Torah, better example, and the Ten Commandments in it. He's known as the lawgiver, the Torah giver, which again, remember, means law, generally speaking, but has more of the sense of instruction. So it includes all kinds of things beside. It's not legalistic, in other words. Moses is the lawgiver. Then we have Elijah, who is the, what? The prophet. The one that everybody remembers as the primary prophet. So Moses and Elijah together are the ones who appear to Jesus at the Transfiguration, right? The law and the prophets, therefore the Old Testament, are coming together with Jesus. On the mount. And David, of course, is the other figure here, and then David is the good king. All kingship things, Messiah, etc., are taken to be from him. And then Solomon following him is the one from whom wisdom comes. They get credit for it, in other words, in terms of how it's understood. as the initiator. Well, so he's known as a wise man, obviously. He's also an intelligent administrator. He's pretty successful at what he tries to do. Now, it's true that in this time period, it's a pretty peaceful time period. There aren't any great empires around to create disturbance. Egypt, as I mentioned, I think the first session, doesn't really want to leave Egypt particularly. They just want to defend. And there's nobody they need to defend against. So they're quiet. And all the big empires, the Babylonians are in decline, but the Assyrians aren't really there yet, much less the later empires that come after them. So it's a quiet time. And Judah and Israel were as numerous as sand of the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. That's nice. Doesn't happen too often in their history. Solomon was sovereign over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines. That might be a little idealistic. The Euphrates is way up there. He undoubtedly had contacts up there, but it's not very likely that he actually had any kind of control. But he did have control as far as Damascus in Syria today. So the kingdom was pretty extensive, and that's what they're trying to say once again. The sand of the sea isn't intended to be taken literally. Euphrates to Egypt is meant to say it's expansive. And when we take it literally, then we start to have to say, well, that can't be right. But that's not what they're trying to say. They're just giving us the picture. Even to the border of Egypt, they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, from the top north of Palestine down to the bottom. All of them, every man, under their vines and fig trees. Everybody lives in safety under their vines and fig trees. That's an important expression, that last one. I wanted to mention that too because you'll find this said in the prophets later. When finally peace comes and the good kingdom arrives and the enemies are done away with, every man will sit under his fig tree or under his vine. When they could, little houses in those days had a vine, fig tree sort of thing nearby, or it was out in fields outside town. And one of the nice things to do in that hot, hot, hot weather was to sit there in the, with a refreshing breeze, and you're covered from the sun. And then the prophecy is basically saying, or in this case it's trying to describe the situation, that's what the situation will be like. I've tried to think of a comparison for us. We'll sit on our decks, or we'll sit on our patios, and John's got a better one, I can tell.
So far, during
the
presidential years of 50.
Oh, okay. Get the point. Thank you. Well, they didn't golf. That's true. But maybe you could even use golfing. If you don't care too much about your strokes and your handicap, if you really are pretty relaxed about it, going out and golfing. Maybe even if you're not relaxed about it, golfing can be a way to experience peace. Yes? Interesting, yes. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that connection. That's good, though, because it makes sense that it is a comparison to Israel and what they are not producing. So it's being used as an example. There aren't any fig trees. And that's part of this, yeah, that if the enemy is there, they're going to be destroying your property. Yeah. And one of the things they destroy is your farmlands and things like that, so you don't have food. So fig trees and vines, they're liable to be destroyed. Now, one other thing, thank you. One other thing that I put in there, the text, the New Revised Standard that I'm putting up here, simply says, all of them under their vines and fig trees. I put in brackets every man, because the RSV has that, the King James has that, all the older translations have that. It's been taken out for generic equality reasons. And in this case, while I think that's great, wherever I can, I would do that. But I think you lose part of the point if it doesn't say every man under his fig tree. Because part of the issue is safety. The men aren't out on the battlefield. The men aren't being threatened with death. There's nothing that's going to harm them. So they can sit peacefully under the fig tree. The women don't tend to do that in the first place. They tend to be inside the house in these days. And they go out when they need to be going to the market or going to the well or other things like that. But they wouldn't normally just sit under the fig tree in the same way. So it loses a whole lot of the significance if you don't take it as what it actually says, which is literally every man. And it's the word for male person in the text. So I wanted to put that there just so you see that. That's how much peace is there. The men are not threatened by anything. It's that good. And if they aren't, then obviously the women aren't. Well, in order to have all this peace, one other thing that happens here is that Solomon makes a marriage alliance. And notice who this is with. The king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. So he brings one of the daughters of Pharaoh. And you have to assume she had lots so Pharaoh could spare a few. You know. brings her into the city of David. Imagine leaving the Nile river and coming to Jerusalem up in the mountains. I mean, this poor lady, she didn't get the best of all deals, except that he's the King Solomon is, as we see, really wealthy. He brings her into the city, and then he keeps her, quote, in his house until he finishes building his house and the house of the Lord, and then he builds her a palace, is the point. She gets her own palace, but she has to wait a while. Think about this. Quite a number of years ago, a few centuries ago, the Jews escaped Egypt with the Pharaoh trying to keep them as slaves. Now, a king of Israel is marrying the daughter of a Pharaoh. How the political winds can change. Then and now, obviously. Well, this obviously helps to secure the peace, too, because what this does, and the main reason for it, because you have to assume Solomon has other wives as well, and he's going to have Jewish or Israelite wives, is that this cements a relationship with Egypt. It's like a treaty. I have one of your family members as a wife, so we are in good terms. And that's been done all through history, right? That's the whole of Western European history, of the kings marrying Spanish ladies, marrying Dutch and Belgian and English, and you know all that intermarriage stuff that was going on. That's the real purpose of pretty much all of it. So anyway, one problem with all of this is that he becomes susceptible. I think I skipped something here. Yeah, sorry. I had one more comment to make, and that was before going there. And that was the whole thing in Solomon's time, in terms of his success, is that he's actually developing commerce and wealth is increasing greatly. Trade is expanding all around into all kinds of kingdoms. He even builds ships, and he ends up using them for trade on the sea. Tribute comes his way from the Canaanite cities that he's got under his control. He gets gifts from visiting royalty. You might think of the Queen of Sheba, who comes to visit. She brings all kinds of riches as offerings to him. And then he also has taxes, which we've heard of before. He ends up then with major building projects. As the money comes in, it gets put into things and makes the place look better, and his fame goes farther and farther, and that brings more in. So it's one of these circular sorts of things. Circular. What's the word I'm trying to say?
Cyclical.
Cyclical. Cyclical. Yeah. And then of all these buildings that he builds, including his own palace and then the queen's palace from Egypt and other major administrative buildings, government buildings, he builds finally the temple, which we'll come back to in a moment. So it's a really prosperous time, right? It sounds great. The only problem is taxes, which we've heard issues about. The tax rate becomes very high because he needs the money to do all this stuff. And not only that, he uses forced labor. He starts to act like all the kings around him. To get these building projects done, I need your help. Get to it, right? That sort of thing. So there's a downside to this that in the long run means that people don't really appreciate him like you would expect. And that comes up when he dies, and the people petition Rehoboam, his son, to be more lenient than Solomon was. Rehoboam doesn't do it, and that leads to the division of the whole kingdom. Okay, then the third one is, here's the usual, it seems like, susceptibility to the temptations of power. He's got all the pomp of a Near Eastern ruler, and he starts to live that way. He has multiple wives. David had multiple wives, as we saw. He had to have with all those children we mentioned. But Solomon goes far beyond that. It makes Saul look like a very moral character, which in many ways he was, right, as we saw 2 weeks ago. We're not really told about very many wives of Solomon or Saul at all. It's not a big thing for him. But as soon as these people become kings and it gets into their head, they take on all the trappings. And David does it, and now Solomon does it even more. And so 1 Kings gives us its judgment of this. King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. And love means is married to, pretty much. That's all it's referring to. But among them are Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. These are all little countries around about them, some of whom have been traditional enemies, and marry a daughter, and you get a covenant with them. And in this case, because of his position, they may have been petitioning, in other words, the kings of these little places may have been petitioning to give him a daughter so that they can make some sort of a treaty. So he's on the beneficiary end of things. From the nations whom the Lord had said to the Israelites, you shall not enter into marriage with those people, neither shall they with you, for they will surely incline your heart to follow their gods. And that's exactly what the text says happened. If a queen or a princess or concubine or whatever is brought into the palace areas, they come with their own retinue. They're given money to be able to live. They are allowed to live their own lifestyle, and their lifestyle includes worshiping their own gods. So now you have to build a shrine for each one of their gods and let them use it, make use of it. And if you're a good husband who wants to keep them on your side, you probably show up now and then with them to these places. So the hint is that Solomon not only allowed these shrines to other gods to be built, but maybe actually worshipped at them. And that's kind of iffy as to whether he in fact did that. But if he did, obviously, that's quite a decline from the wisdom. Wasn't that what we said he was all about? So then the last little line there, right? You already have read that probably. Among his wives were 700 princesses and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. Ladies, you always have control of your husband's hearts, don't you? Said like a man, right? Anyway, so what do you make of the 700 and 300? What does that total to? 1,000. So, given what we said about numbers here, it's around numbers, right? The point isn't that there were literally 1,000 ladies running around in Jerusalem. That'd be a fair portion of the population. It has more to do with the idea that he's got large numbers, and in this case, it's not necessarily positive, obviously. It's negative. And they will do that too.
So
Carl?
40 years, Jim, that's only 50
years. Thank you. This is math class. Nothing like an educator in the classroom. Yeah, that's true. 50 a year. One a week. Well, I think this all shows kind of the danger, at least, of a downward trend, right, for people who are in significant positions of power. Then the final one, and this is the one I want to emphasize most, is his central achievement, which is to build what is called a house of the Lord. The word house is literally a word house that can be used for the palace. Solomon has a house and so forth. But obviously in this context it gets to mean temple. And in other languages like Greek there are words for that. The Hebrew doesn't do that. It just has this one word that it uses. And you can tell from the context what's being referred to. Well, if you think back to your history a little bit of the Old Testament, when the people were in the wilderness, they had the Ark of the Covenant, and they had a tabernacle that they set up. It was a portable tent that they did all their worship in. And once they got into Palestine, then the Ark ended up in different locations during the period of the Judges. It gets moved around. Some people were afraid to have it in their own town, actually. And so it's not really settled completely. Now, when David takes Jerusalem, remember, and makes that the capital city and the center of everything, trying to unify everybody, he then has the Ark brought to Jerusalem. And that makes Jerusalem the religious center, in a sense, for the people. Not that they all go where the Ark is. That wasn't the normal practice at the time. But now, in Solomon's time, the temple is built, a place to house the Ark. When that happens, Jerusalem literally becomes the central place for worship of the God of Israel. That's where you will find the God of Israel. Not that he's not other places, but this is the central location. And that being the case, it cements Jerusalem, right? It turns it into the place. Well, think that this was, Solomon died around 922 BC. So we're talking 900 plus 2,000 years. We're talking 3,000 years ago, practically. Jerusalem became central to the Israelites and through them to the Christians and Islam as well, when Islam came on the scene, still today. Any wonder that Jerusalem could be fought over? In our day and age, and that the political issues related to it are phenomenal. It is simply the center. And when Solomon builds the temple, this is an artist's rendition of it, and I'm not going to go through it in detail with you. I just wanted you to see. The idea is it's a glorified building. There's cedar brought from Lebanon. That's the wood for it, expensive. And there's gold inlay and gold plating and gold utensils. And as you see, it's gold. and it shows the wealth that's present in Jerusalem at this time. It becomes then the way that you can tell Solomon is not only doing pretty well, he's really at the top. And is really probably the central figure in the whole of the Middle East right at that point. Middle East, that is, along the seaboard of the Mediterranean. The result is pretty quickly people start coming more regularly to Jerusalem for worship, especially for the big feasts, Passover and things like that. And one of the famous psalms is one of the psalms that's sung on pilgrimage. How lovely, and we know this, right? The choir sings this regularly. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord of hosts. You can almost hear that melody, probably. How my soul longs, indeed it faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. And then, here's a little note that I just love. Even the sparrow finds a home. I remember when I was here, quite a few years ago now, one of the big problems was all the pigeons up in the tower that we couldn't get rid of. And we tried all sorts of things to get rid of them. But hey, they even found a home in the church. Well, that's what's being said here, because under the eaves you can see the sparrows coming in there regularly. Wonderful place, protected place, cool place, etc. Even the sparrow finds a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Her young, her infants are safe in the temple, even the animals. At your altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. The thing that strikes me with this, too, in addition to the sparrows and the tower piece, is really the other part. How lovely is your dwelling place? When I first came to Westminster, even to interview years and years and years ago, I thought, this is really lovely. This sanctuary is just beautiful. Everything about it is. And every time I come back, I have the same reaction. It's just a peaceful, warm, lovely place to be. I assume you think that every now and then, if not lots of times. But if you're going still to worship again at 11, just look around and think about that. That's what the psalmist is talking about when the psalmist says that. I'm going to skip this because of time pressure, I think. But the temple goes through a number of permutations, and by the end, at 70 AD, in just after Jesus' lifetime, the Romans destroy it, right? As they destroy Jerusalem, and that's the end of the temple. But so significant is that temple that Jews today still go to the Wailing Wall. It's foundations of the temple as Herod reconstructed it. And you're really touching part of that temple from 2,000 years ago when you touch those stones. They probably go back to Solomon's time, actually, I think. That's how central it still is in Jewish minds, but Christian ones too, obviously. I want you to take a little bit of time here. We have only a few minutes, actually, to do this, but I'm going to send these around. Oh, thank you. I was just going to let them send them around, but if you can pass some. Those are selections that you're receiving from 1 Kings chapter 8. This is the point where the temple is dedicated. Solomon has a dedication ceremony and a long prayer, and it's all kind of intermixed. But these are very central pieces from it. So what I'd like to do, in the interest of time and fun, is to have you guys work on this just briefly. So you'll see there's three sections, obviously. And so how about if the folks here back to here maybe do the first section, and there's two questions to look at quickly. You don't have long to do this. If you want to talk to a neighbor, that's fine too for maybe 3-4 minutes, but that's about it. And then the second group over here, and maybe, right back here, you two aisles, take the second set, and then the rest of you the third set, okay? It's not quite even, but that's all right. Just look for what you think is probably the answer to these. Or at least an answer to them.
Given the time, just one more minute. Let's take a quick look at these. The first one is part of the dedication. When the priest came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord. What do you think? Cloud? Why cloud? What does that suggest to you?
Reminded me of a cloud that led Israelites into the wilderness for 40
years. Yeah, a cloud that was leading them in the wilderness.
Also Moses on the mountain.
And Moses on the mountain. Yeah. So if there's clouds, what about your vision? Yeah, if it's thick clouds anyway, right? And that's then the second part, where I use the word thick. The Lord has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. What's that then suggest?
We're not supposed to see the face of God.
We don't see God, right? Yeah, God is beyond anything that we can see or understand. Some of you have heard of the way of negation, the via negativa, it's called in medieval theology, trying to get at the same point, saying, well, God is light. That's one of the great statements we make about God. But that suggests that you would see a bright light. That would be seeing something. So that goes against this. Well, but actually God is so much more than light that God is actually darkness. God is beyond light. And you say something and you say it's not light, it's the opposite. As a way to say God is so immense, so great. This is the way they're trying to say it here, obviously, in this text. And then the next set is, what did God, the Lord God promise to David? What did you all find? David would be on the throne of Israel. And what else? Who would build the temple? I'm sorry. Solomon would. I'm sorry, I just didn't hear. Yeah, Solomon would build the temple. And he's done that now. So what God said... and what affirmations about God's nature does Solomon make?
Actually, because of what you talked about earlier, I noticed the two words, like you. It's like those other women from all the other kingdoms may have had an influence. That there, if he doesn't say there is only one God, there's no God like you. That was when the two words popped out.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to raise that, thank you. Because, this is an affirmation that there's only one supreme God, right? This is not an affirmation that there aren't other gods. The Old Testament, it's striking to us, but think of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. It doesn't say there aren't any other gods. It just says, you're the one who's the highest, you're the one we shall worship. It's actually fairly late in Israel's history. And bear this in mind as we come to next week about how revelation in the Old Testament works. It's progressive. And it's actually probably at the time of Isaiah, 600 or so, 300 years after this, the people are clearly saying there are no other gods. And not everybody believed it. That's why they still worried about other gods. But maybe they had some kind of power. But that's the point. Like you is what's being said. But the difference is, this one God is supreme, all-powerful. There's one other thing about the difference. At least one other thing. Anybody see that?
God's steadfast love.
That's precisely right. Yeah, steadfast love. God's attitude is always positive. Judgment can come. That's a different issue. But God's face that we can't see towards the earth is one that is loving, even to those who are thieves on the cross, etc. I mean, all these things that we've seen along the way. That reminds me of Haiti, which I mentioned before in the mission trips there. The voodoo that goes on in Haiti. People, there are a lot of so-called gods related to that. And often they are understood to harm other people. You go to this or that witch doctor to put a curse on somebody. Or you wouldn't go to the God of Israel to put a curse on somebody. You would go to the God of Israel to have somebody die on a cross for that person. The God of Israel is steadfast love. That's one of the major revelations. And it takes a long time for that to seep into the psyche, I guess you could say. Okay, and then the final one is, can God really dwell in an earthly house? Nothing can contain God. Okay, so what about the temple then? What's happening in the temple?
His name.
If you read that text, all of a sudden, and it's actually mentioned earlier as well in the same chapter, God's name dwells there. In other words, you can get to God there. But it's not that God's being is contained in that temple. Some people think that this is actually written later as, again, Israel gradually develops its understanding that it's not God who's there, but it's God's name. God is much too big for any one temple. That's what the other gods are like. They're limited to their little mountaintops or their temples or shrines. God isn't that way. So there's one final question about your last one that I didn't ask there, and that is, what's the purpose of the temple? If you look at the last line, notice what he says. Hear the plea of your servant and your people Israel when they pray towards this place. Oh, hear in heaven your dwelling place. Heed, hear and heed. And what? Forgive. Then we get a long list of people to forgive. When we have done this, when we have done that. And then one of those is when the foreigner comes to this house and prays to God for partially for the purposes of foreigners knowing that you are the true God, hear and forgive the foreigner as well. So right here already there's an emphasis on foreigners, not just Israel. There's more to what God's about with in the Old Testament and with Israel than just Israel. A lesson they forget continually, and sounds like a lot of us in the church, in certain segments anyway, are forgetting fairly often too these days. Okay, so we're out of time. I thought it would be fun to give you an assignment this time. This is tough. Saul, David, and Solomon are all messiahs, anointed ones. Remember the general meaning of it. What similarities and dissimilarities strike you between each of them and the one whom we know as Jesus the Christ, Jesus the Messiah? Should have capped the there. What differences and similarities do you find between this one whom Revelation calls the King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Huh, we should sing that too. Okay, would you bring that next time? Because this is an assignment for next time. That's a subtle way of saying come back next week. Anyway, no, we are out of time. So thank you very much, and see you next time.